Well, all week we've been waiting for the sentencing of the two teens who were the main perpetrators in the Kefu home invasion at Coorparoo in 2021. And of course, Ben Cannon being the neighbour there sparked what we now know as the Voice for Victims movement. For 2 days in a row, there were delays because there were problems getting the two young offenders into the courtroom. We still don't quite understand what happened there. Eventually, yesterday afternoon, quite late in the day, we heard that the submissions wrapped up and Justice Peter Davies has reserved his decision for a future date yet to be set. What we did hear, though, was that the prosecution pushed for the crime to be considered particularly heinous, and that, again, would allow for the judge to see a sentence beyond 10 years, similar to what we saw in the case of Emma Lovell. In that case, of course, though, Emma had her life taken from her. The lawyer for one of the 15-year-old boys described his client's actions as being reactive, while the other boy's lawyer said there was no planned attack that night. Just this morning, police charged again another two teenage boys, a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old, over the suspicious house fires that happened at Mango Hill. We spoke to one of those owners yesterday. So I'm going to try and take some of the emotion out of these cases because it is very easy, and rightfully so, for us to get a very emotive about them. Instead, I wanted to get an understanding of what's happening from a legal perspective, what other options the judge has, and if we are looking to give them additional tools, what would they look like, and how would we go about changing the way we approach the sentencing of these cases? So joining us once again on 4BC Afternoons is Calvin Ganek. He's a former police officer. He's now a criminal lawyer and the managing director of Ganek and Associates and a friend here of Afternoons. How are you, Calvin?
Hi, Sophie. How are you?
Yeah, really well. And thank you for doing this with me today. I know we've put it off a couple of times because we were hoping that we would have the sentencing from yesterday's case as well. And I know that you'd be right across what's happening here, Calvin. These cases, of course, so high profile and very difficult, I think, for anyone to talk about without feeling the emotion. The prosecution in the case of the Kefu family is pushing for it to be considered to being particularly heinous. And that they were malicious acts with intent. Those words will change the way the sentencing would be available for the judge in this case, right?
That's correct. It's actually quite a complicated scheme to understand, even for lawyers at times. So you've summarised it quite accurately, though, Sophie. So the Youth Justice Act governs sentencing of juveniles here in Queensland, and there's a maximum sentence of 10 years to start with for 10 years imprisonment for children who have been convicted of a life offence. There is an exception to that, and that is once the juvenile is convicted of a life offence, if the court makes a finding, firstly, that the offence involves a commission of violence against a person, and secondly, that it's particularly heinous, and that is that the offence is particularly heinous, that then allows the court to increase that maximum penalty from that 10 years to anything up to life imprisonment. So those findings have to happen. And then if we could talk about the Emma Lovell case just for a moment, because that applied to, as you've indicated, a murder charge, that then would invoke the mandatory parole eligibility dates if the court firstly found that it was particularly heinous and then exercised its discretion to order a life imprisonment, then there would be mandatory minimum times for parole eligibility, starting at 20 years for a single murder. So that's the scheme that applies. And in regards to the Emma Lovell case, the court found that it was a particularly heinous offence, so then was able to exercise its discretion past the 10 years and ordered the 14 years.
And then because of the Youth Justice Act, it can only be a maximum of 70% of that time served?
That's correct. And there's also a discretionary, as you've described, Sophie, a maximum. So it can be reduced, but a maximum of that 70%.
Yeah. So in that case, then in particular, if we're talking about the Emma Lovell case, the judge could have gone for a sentence that was beyond 14 years. Because I think we hear 14 years, but everybody goes, well, we say that he's been sentenced to 14 years, but he's certainly not going to be spending 14 years behind bars. at maximum, it'll be 70% of that time. But with time served, he'll be out in 2032.
So there's an exception to that. You're right again, Sophie.
I love it when you say that, Kelvin. Music to my ears.
you've been reporting on these things for too long. So it is a parole eligibility day because of how serious the offence is. So the offender is required to apply for parole, and their rehabilitation, their risk to the community is assessed for them to get parole, as opposed to routinely offences that are sentenced in the magistrate's court where there is a parole release date where the court orders they be released on a certain date. For offences of this nature, the justices make that determination, and it's a parole eligibility date only. So they're not automatically released upon that 70% that's discussed.
Mm. You would know, and if you ever listen to 4BC across any time of the day, that there is certainly community outrage and a sense that there is not justice in the sentences that have been handed down. And we've heard many times from other families who are grieving their loved ones at the hands of a youth offender who are now waiting for their time to go through the courts and see what sentence is handed down in those cases. What needs to change, Kelvin, if we were to give the judges the tools to be able to increase the sentencing? Everybody is pushing for minimum mandatory sentencing. It would appear that at this point, no political party is saying that they would look at that. But if we're going, do you know what, it just doesn't seem like this is enough, particularly when we learn a little bit more about the criminal history of some of the people involved, what would need to happen if there was to be change to see those sentences be longer?
So fundamentally in Queensland, we have a precedent system. So that is that the Court of Appeal oversees these types of sentences. So in the case of Emma's case, it could be appealed to the Court of Appeal asking for a harsher sentence. And in those circumstances, those decisions from the Court of Appeal are then used as precedent for single judges sitting in the Supreme Court or the District Court in regards to these types of sentences. So I anticipated you were going to ask a question like this, Sophie. So I've got a little bit of some former cases. There was a case in 2008 where a 16-year-old boy shot his brother twice in the head, and he put the body in his car, threw it in the river, lied about it to his parents. In regards to that case, he did not receive life. He did receive life under the former regime. And there was also a 16-year-old in 1999 in regards to the death of a female Japanese tourist where he received life. In 2007, we had a 16-year-old who shot his sleeping father in the head. He received 12 years detention. And perhaps the most prominent, in 2011, was a 14-year-old, almost 15-year-old, killed a 42-year-old man with a fence paling near Musgrave Park. Mm. And he was originally sentenced to life imprisonment, and the Queensland Court of Appeal reduced that to 12 years detention. So the current system is a precedent-based system where the Court of Appeal gives guidance in regards to those sentences. So the only way around that is for the Court of Appeal to hand down harsher sentencing outcomes, or, as you say, something that neither government is willing to go near at this point in time, and that is minimum mandatory sentencing regime.
And then the next part of it would be, Kelvin, and I know that you'd be aware, not just from your position now working within the criminal justice system, but also in the time that you've spent as a police officer, that when we're talking about our youth offenders, and just so much focus is on them, but I think that this goes to criminality regardless of the person's age, this concept of rehabilitation. You know, we keep hearing about in the case of youth, that they're often children who are reoffending, who are out on bail. We now, you know, even of the case this morning that I told everybody about, these two teenage boys, one sort of seems to have just gone in and out of the courtroom and told that that was not a very good thing to do and don't do it again. Do we have do you think, and I guess this is to a degree a personal opinion of yours, is the rehabilitation system adequately funded and resourced so that we are doing a good job of making sure that these people come back into the community able to be good citizens, or are we still lacking a little bit in that?
I think the answer to that is an overwhelming we are lacking. It's uncontroversial to state that sending young people to detention only really teaches them to be better criminals at the moment.
Right.
Because if you send a young person that's been in trouble a little bit and it's time to protect the community, you send them into the system, they're then associating on a daily basis with, unfortunately, some really hardened youth, young offenders, and they just learn how to be better criminals. They create that network, they have more contact. So that's very undesirable, and that's one of the significant factors that is constantly raised about taking a view to just locking up young offenders and trying to access rehabilitation before we get to that point. I've said on this program a number of times that it's unfortunate that by the time authorities even get a young person on the radar, it's perhaps starting to be too late, because by that time they're probably not going to school. They've got a total disregard to any type of authority, whether it be parents, teachers, or law enforcement. And now jumping into my personal opinion, Sophie, I think there's a focus upon keeping the community happy, perhaps even from a political point of view, and we're using up the resources for unnecessary matters. And I don't want to overstate that or undermine how serious certain cases are, but it doesn't matter whether we talk about youth offending or domestic violence. The budget can only go so far. Mm. And in my experience, there's a whole lot of that budget being spent at the lower end where it's not so important. So therefore, the top end of that offending, the top end of that protection in domestic violence, we don't have the resources, the rehabilitation, or in domestic violence, the gated protected communities for the very vulnerable to go into, because it just doesn't go around. The budget doesn't go everywhere. So in some way, I think there has to be a refocus on those that really need it, so that the funding is not wasted — might be a harsh word — but wasted on the unnecessary cases that don't need that type of funding put into them.
And then that's so frustrating to hear you say, because we thought that maybe we would have a new way forward with an independent committee that would have a bipartisan approach to some of those things that you're talking about, so that there was more efficient use of not just money but time as well, and a bit more of a long-term focus, or at least a medium-term focus, rather than it just be one election cycle to the next. And what you're saying is, if that had been successful, whether it be around the youth justice issues or crime more broadly, we would probably have better outcomes because the money would be more efficiently spent.
Yes, that's correct. And I don't want to overstate that, because it requires a little bit of crystal ball gazing, which is very difficult, whether it be the judicial officers trying to determine whether someone's worthy of a rehabilitation sentence, or even the bail issue that is constantly raised and the community is very frustrated about. It really is crystal ball gazing to, will this person reoffend if I give them bail? Will this person grasp onto these rehabilitation prospects, avenues that I'm offering? So it is a really difficult topic, but from a theoretical point of view, if we can somehow identify and focus where those resources need to be efficiently placed at the higher end, they're not being wasted at the lower end unnecessarily just to get a figure or just in case.
Do you think that it is fair, the amount of criticism that is levelled at the judiciary?
No. It's a very difficult job. Like I said, it's very difficult to gaze into the future and predict what someone will or won't do. I can almost guarantee no judicial officer sits there to try and do the wrong thing. The law is a very complex area to practice in. It's a very it's scrutinised by the public, by the media, and I am sure they all try and do the right thing and follow the law that they have in front of them.
Thank you so much for your time, as always, Calvin Ganek. You see things from both sides, having, you know, spent time obviously as a police officer and now trying to navigate it in your role as the managing director of Ganek and Associates. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks, Sophie. Have a good afternoon.
That's Calvin Ganek, and I know that there'll be people who didn't, you know, don't like the answer, but you know, that's the if precedent is what they go by when they're making these decisions, then the only other way to do it is to agitate politically. And you heard it, and I'll say it again: neither side is saying minimum mandatory sentences, and neither side really have, I think, a clear vision for what rehabilitation looks like. And it's so much focus on young criminals, but these young criminals grow up then to be the adult criminals. And if we don't have a process by which to be certain that they're not going to reoffend, then it is nothing but crystal balling. And the one thing that we can do is try to go further back upstream and identify where they're coming from before they slip through the cracks. And so many young people, unfortunately, in our community are slipping through those cracks.